Accession number 19907, Reel 1.
Colonel Dillon, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Bristol, Gloucestershire, on the 12th of August 1919. You asked me what my reaction was before the war. Well, I feel a bit guilty about that because I was commissioned on the 1st of July at the age of 19, and I spent quite a lot of time playing cricket and going on a cricketing tour and going to parties and dances and so on. It was a time of unemployment, and it was a period just before the war, and I feel a bit guilty about it looking back. However, I joined my regiment in August, the 2nd Battalion of the Gloucestershire Regiment stationed at Plymouth, and funnily enough, I was playing cricket again, and in the middle of the cricket match, the adjutant sent for me, and he said, pack your bags, take 24 hours leave, and report to Greenock for embarkation on the Britannic, which I did, and I think we had something like 2,000 officers and men on the Britannic, and we sailed, I suppose it must have been through the canal, but I can hardly remember, to Bombay. And when we got to Bombay, we spent 2 days crossing India to Calcutta, then by ship to Rangoon, to a place called Mingledown, which was about 15 miles north of Rangoon. It was the airfield. And it was where my 1st Battalion of the Gloucestershire Regiment was located. At that time, of course, early in the war, the amount of training we did was pretty minimal because we were in an internal security battalion. There was a considerable amount of strife in Burma at that time because they were seeking independence. And so we were on IS operations for a lot of the time, were unable to do any other kind of training.
Did you see anything of these civil disturbances yourself?
Yes, because we had to dispatch platoons and companies to various parts of Burma. Although, in fact, we had one battalion, which was ours, in Rangoon, and another battalion, which was the KOLI, in Mae Mew, which was in the north of the country. But at that time, I should say that there was no feeling of war at all in Burma, or for that matter, in India either. There was a great deal of apathy, and the war was a long, long way away. And so we were, like everybody else in that part of the world, totally unprepared for any further war. We carried out our training to a very limited extent. We were badly equipped. For example, we had medium machine guns, Vickers. They were carried on mules. We had 3-inch mortars, which were carried on mules. We had signal equipment, which was mainly by helio or line, sounds terribly old-fashioned now, also carried by mules. And so we were unfit for a modern type of warfare. Later on, we got better equipment, and we exchanged, for example, our mules for carriers. I suppose In the days just before Pearl Harbor, was a period of, to some extent, great excitement, because one must remember that a lot of American aid was coming in by sea to Rangoon and was being taken up into China via the Burma Road. Well, early bits of the Burma Road, in fact, passed through our battalion lines. And when war was actually declared and the Japanese bombers had come over and bombed Rangoon, there was a great movement of vehicles and guns and stores from Rangoon into China. A lot of the stuff broke down, and there were big parks in Rangoon, sort of semi-guarded by the Chinese. And so these vehicles that broke down, I'm afraid we just nipped out onto the roads and recovered them and mended them and used a lot of the vehicles and equipment and guns, which we quite frankly pinched, later on in the war. I might say that at this particular time, we had some visitors who came and joined the battalion. They were white Russians. They'd come from China, and they hated the Japanese. They were also extremely good mechanics, and so they were extremely useful in mending some of these vehicles and putting them on the road. And also, I might say, very good fighters indeed. In fact, some got decorated. And because they hated the Japanese so much, they were pretty assertive. And nothing pleased them more than stick their bayonets into a Japanese, which is, in fact, what happened. Anyway, to go back again, when Pearl Harbor was taken, or bombed, rather, the whole of the attitude in Burma changed. And, of course, we had to be prepared for an invasion. At that particular time, you will remember, the Vichy government had colluded with the Japanese, so they were in French Indochina at that time, in Bangkok, correction, in Saigon. So it was an easy move for them, once they started their invasion of the Malayan Peninsula, to move across into Siam, now Thailand, which was next door to Burma. So they had a good launching pad for their invasion of Burma, which in due time they did, having previously bombed Mingledon airfield and Rangoon and started a tremendous rush of refugees out of Rangoon towards India. The actual movement of Japanese troops was by and large aimed at Rangoon. Two divisions, at least, came across the frontier and moved in the direction of Rangoon. Just before that, the 7th Armored Brigade, with their tanks, had come from the desert, and so we had some kind of reinforcements. But in their move across towards Rangoon, the Japanese had to cross over a river called the Satang, where there was a big bridge. Satang is a very big river indeed, half a mile wide, more than that in many places. The Satang Bridge was a vital communication. And then there came the moment when it was a question of blowing the bridge up. We were withdrawing, when I say we, this was 17th Division, we were withdrawing, and there came a time when half the division was on the Rangoon side of the Satang, and many of the soldiers and units were on the other side. And so the problem was when to blow the bridge. If you did it too late, the Japanese would come across and walk straight into Rangoon. If you did it too early, then you'd leave half your troops on the wrong side. As it happens, there was a mess up and the thing was blown up accidentally, and so that decided that. But that was the beginning of the pullback of 7th Armored Brigade and 17th Division back to a place called Taokyan. Taokyan was, in that area, was like the letter Y, the base of the Y being Rangoon, the line joining the two arms was through our lines from Rangoon. The right arm went up to Mandalay into Yunnan and China, and the left arm went up really towards Assam. And it was at that road junction where the whole of the army in Burma was concentrated, and we, the battalion, then in Mingaladon, were told to move pretty rapidly up to Taukyan, which we did. This meant abandoning everything we had, apart from our fighting kit. I might say that, of course, long before that, families and children had been evacuated from Burma, and in fact, my present wife, who was PA to the AOC, had also been evacuated. In her particular case, she had quite a hairy escape. Because she was working with the RAF, she was evacuated eventually by Blenheim bomber. The first plane that took off was, in fact, shot down by Japanese fighters who were very active in that area, but her plane survived and she managed to get flown back to India. Anyway, going back to Taukyan with Rangoon burning behind us, what was utterly indescribable. If you can imagine a whole division plus and an armored brigade concentrated in something like a few miles of road with jungle on one side and open paddy fields on the other, held up by a roadblock, which led on the road, as I just said, which eventually went to Assam. The reason for that roadblock, we discovered afterwards, was that one of the Japanese divisions was going to bypass the army in Burma and move round towards the west and attack Rangoon from the north. They thought that Rangoon was going to be heavily defended, like Singapore was, and in fact it wasn't, of course, it was evacuated. But in order to make that move, they set up a flank protection. This, to protect their division advancing on Rangoon, this flank protection consisted of a major roadblock, which was the cause of the army in Burma not being able to move and thereby stuck at this place, Taukyan. The scene at Taukyan was, one can never forget it. It was extremely noisy because we were being attacked by Japanese fighters, Zero fighters. There were the sound of guns and the sight of tanks here, petrol buses, ambulances, three tunners, 1,500 weights, mules, animals, soldiers, utterly indescribable. And we were ordered to attack this roadblock and remove it so that the army could get away up north, as I said, towards Assam. Attacking, we arrived, I suppose, about 12 o'clock at Taukyan and told straight away to make this attack. We really required armoured support and artillery support, but for various reasons it wasn't available. The guns couldn't fire because they were too close together, there were too many trees, and as far as tanks were concerned, the commanders wanted to retain in an entity the 7th Armoured Brigade as the only really tough fighting force. So it was left more or less to us, infantry battalion by itself, to take this roadblock and destroy any Japanese anti-tank guns and any other Japanese who were there. I suppose we must have made three or four assaults down the road and on either side. There was a lot of fighting, a lot of close range fighting. I remember one of our carriers going up the road, turning round, and there, slap in front of it, was a Japanese anti-tank gun. The driver was able to fire his Bren gun and killed all the gun crew before the gun fired. The second carrier wasn't so lucky, and the anti-tank gun blew the thing off the road. But there was a lot of close fighting like that. And I remember personally speaking that this was the first time I'd been shot at. And I remember being on the road, a little way back from the roadblock, when I saw a number of Japanese crossing the road from right to left. Then there was I could see them setting up their guns, and then there was a lot of machine gun fire. And I remember thinking at that time, for a brief second, God's sake, look out, you're going to kill someone. In fact, that's, of course, what they were trying to do. But it was a funny feeling. It only lasted a second. One time the CO said to the adjutant, you'd better go up the road in your jeep and just tell me what's going on. He went up. He came back in shortly afterwards with two or three wounded chaps, and he himself was mortally wounded. In fact, he died pretty quickly. The CO turned to me and said, right, you are now adjutant of the battalion. There I was at the ripe old age of 21 or 22, with really no experience at all, suddenly made adjutant of an infantry battalion. Anyway, eventually, with the assistance of Gurkhas and Indian Army troops, we broke through the roadblock. But this was really mainly due to the fact that the Japanese division had gone past, and there was no need for the flank protection anymore, and they began to break away. So we were able to get through on the road. And then from that moment onwards, we were told to be the reconnaissance battalion. This meant that we were the rear guard of the whole of the Army in Burma, and our role was reconnaissance, which meant really that we had to keep the Japanese advance at bay as best we could, at the same time gain as much information about the Japanese, their strengths, their directional advances, and all the information which we could gather for the divisional commander. We were engaged in two set-piece battles, which I can describe later maybe, and then after that we too got caught up in further roadblocks, and I'm afraid because of these roadblocks where there was pretty intense fighting, we lost a lot of men and a lot of equipment. Our first set-piece battle was at a place called Let Padan. As I say, we were rear guard, and so with the assistance of the Burma police and Burma Frontier Force and a splendid chap called Donald, who in fact was a friend of my family's, who was a Burma police officer and who could speak Burmese, we got information that the Japanese were going to arrive at Let Padan on such and such a date. We knew that the Burmese, or Donald had told us, that the Burmese in the village were going to lay on a civic reception for the Japanese advancing. We knew this, and so our CO signaled back to General Khan, who was the commander of 17 Div, and said that the Burmese in this village were arranging a civic reception for the Japanese. We too will arrange a reception, which we did. This was quite a tricky operation. We had to know exactly when the Japanese were going to arrive, and in fact, we thought they were going to arrive on a certain night, but they didn't, so we had to postpone the whole of the operation for 24 hours. But the plan was to try and attack them before they really settled in. It just so happened from north to south, there were two roads into Let Padan, the left one and the right one, down towards Let Padan. This was excellent from the point of view of an assault, with a lateral road. So we sent one platoon down the main road on the left with orders to draw attention to themselves and attract enemy fire so that the Japanese would think that they were being attacked down the main road. In the meantime, we sent a company round on the right-hand side of the road to attack the village from a flank. They were well supported by 3-inch mortars and carriers, by which time, incidentally, the mortars from some of the equipment which were pinched from the Chinese were white scout cars, half tracks. And what we'd done is to put the 3-inch mortars on the backs of these trucks so that there was complete mobility. Anyway, the carriers and the mortars were sent round to the right flank, and they let off a hell of a lot of ammunition into the village with their machine guns and mortars, firing a tremendous number of mortars in a minute. At the same time, D Company, it was, under a chap called Richard Johnson, attacked the village from the side. They caught the Japanese completely by surprise, and some of them were still in bungalows and wooden buildings and so on, and in fact some of them jumped from the upper floors down to the ground, and that's where some of the soldiers learnt the art of sticking their bayonets not to the front, as we used to do dummy bayonet practice, but upwards, which was quite amusing in some ways. I remember the company commander telling me afterwards that he tripped up over a little bit of a fence as he was advancing with his company into the village, and a Japanese from a building near him started firing a machine gun at him. He rolled over this way, and he rolled over that way, and avoided being hit. And I remember him saying to me that he thought he bore a charmed life. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way, because he was killed later on. Anyway, the rest of the company, at close quarters with their bayonets, routed the Japanese from the village, and they fled in confusion. There was no organized resistance at all. The CO thought that maybe this is getting out of control, and he didn't really want to get involved in a long battle, because our task really was to provide information, give the Japanese a bloody nose or something like that, and then provide information, so he withdrew the company. But the other platoon on the left flank, which had the task of drawing enemy fire on it, had a pretty torrid time. They got entangled with quite a big force of Japanese. Anyway, suffice it to say that one section didn't survive. They found themselves in a building. They were attacked by about 50. This section, I might say, consisted of about 6 or 7 chaps. And they were attacked by about 50 or 60 Japanese at close range. These soldiers were extremely gallant. They put up a fight to the very, very end. And they resisted and went on fighting until eventually the Japanese came into the building, and they were either killed or captured. And in fact, those who were captured were sent back to prisoners of war camps, and we know what they were like. And eventually, after the war, they returned, and they were all right. But it was a very gallant action. And the chap who was in charge of it, Sergeant Biggs, got decorated for that. But that was one battle that we were involved in. The CO withdrew the whole of the force back, something like 8 miles or something like that, to a rendezvous where the second-in-command and the quartermaster had arranged a great big hot meal, which is what the troops wanted more than anything else. And it was a success, and we had achieved what the divisional commander had asked for. And in fact, he wrote, at the end of the operation, the CO got 2 signals. One was from Alexander, General Alexander. It said, heartiest congratulations on splendid operation at Leh Padang, congratulate company commander from me personally. And then another signal from General Khan, the divisional commander, my heartiest congratulations to you and all ranks. A splendid show and just what I wanted. You have set a fine example of enterprise and proved that we can defeat the Jap at his own game. Chief was delighted. And after that operation, the company commander was given the MC. The next operation we were engaged in was at a place called Pang Dae. Again, we were told that the Japanese would be entering Pang Dae on such and such a date. And again, the CO decided the way to deal with the situation was to attack them again, to delay them and to provide information for the divisional commander. Very briefly, the plan was very similar to Leh Padang. But this time he was going to take a risk. In order to do it quickly, he had to move the assaulting companies, two of them, by vehicle, almost within machine gun range of the Japanese. And again, the carriers and the mortars went on round on the flank and provided covering support. The two companies who disembarked from vehicles had to cross open paddy land and assault Pang Dae right from the front, and they suffered quite a lot of casualties. But eventually they got up to the village and succeeded in making some of the Japanese withdraw. Again, the CO didn't want to get in too deeply involved, so he stopped the assault. And funnily enough, we hadn't got radios then, and the only way to draw attention to the companies who were doing the advance and making the assault was by bugle. So he ordered the bugler to sound anything he could, like the retreat, and come to the cookhouse, store boys, anything. The two companies got the message, stopped, and came back. There was that stage where Peter Vorwell was wounded. Again, the companies had, and the support platoons had worked like clockwork. It was beautifully done, and with minimum casualties, really. And after the battle was over, the CO withdrew everybody back again another 8 miles.